Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. Welcome to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. Well, today is Labor Day, and we're happy to celebrate all of our hardworking farmers and ranchers with a special edition of the Edible Community Show. We're going to be talking with author Pamela Walker, whose new book is Growing Good Things to Eat in Texas. We'll also visit with three of the subjects of her mesmerizing book, Carol Ann Sale of Boggy Creek Farm, Bart Reed of Permian Sea Organics, and David Petrie of Tecolote Farm. I'd also like to invite listeners to write me at marla@edibleaustin.com to win a free copy of Pam's book. Just tell me a little bit about why you think organic sustainable farming is important to you, and a winner will be selected and announced on my next show. I'd also like to congratulate the winner of the Fresh movie DVD that we gave away on one of my last shows. It's a home-licensed version to show up to 20 people. Her name is Lindsay J. Fromm, and here's just a little bit about what she wrote. She says, "My support for the sustainable food movement manifests itself in a variety of ways, including seeking out the New York City restaurants that carry heritage meat, patronizing the local Fort Greene Green Market whenever possible, including in the middle of January, just to support the farmers who are brave enough to face the cold, and buying local and organic whenever I do end up at the grocery store." She says that she's trying to plant her own spice garden in her apartment, and she's convinced her mother, who lives in suburban Long Island, to get a CSA share. So she says, "Why am I such a huge supporter? Because I love to eat healthy, delicious food, and I know if corporate America had their way, small-time farmers, along with heritage meats and heirloom vegetables, would be diminished. So thanks for all you're doing and helping to spread the word on sustainable food." So thank you, Lindsay, and we'll be sending you that DVD of the great movie Fresh. So we're going to take a quick break here and be back with author Pam Walker. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. Pam Walker is a former academic librarian, college English teacher, and the assistant director of the Center for Study of Culture at Rice University. She and her husband own a small farm near Schulenburg, Texas, about 100 miles from their home in Houston. Here's a brief quote from Alan Jones, who wrote the intro to the book, and I'm going to read it because it does such a good job of describing what she's done with the book. He says, "Pamela Walker takes a personal approach to describing the family businesses featured in this book. She weaves together biographical information, photographs, and the details of farming, aquaculture, ranching, dairying, food processing, soil and livestock management, and marketing techniques. The results are intimate stories of families struggling to realize their dreams in the face of economic and personal challenges, and an agriculture and food marketing system designed for large-scale conventional and non-organic agriculture. And so these are the stories of the men, women, and children who make up the organic agricultural movement in Texas." So welcome to the show, Pam.
Thank you, Marla.
I appreciate your being on the show today. I know you've got a busy schedule with your book tour right now.
Well, it's wonderful to have this opportunity.
First of all, how did you find and come to choose the 11 farmers and ranchers that you feature in the book?
I got deeply involved in farmers market organizing work in about 1999 and organized a small market in Schulenburg. And then after that, got involved with Urban Harvest, a Houston community gardening organization, and led in organizing the Bayou City Farmers Market for that organization from 2002 to 2006. And in the course of market organizing, I did so much research and so much footwork, literally, that I met a lot of interesting farmers, and I had also, over the years in my travels, paid a lot of attention to farmers markets in other states that are much more developed than those that we have in Texas, because they were organized much earlier. For example, the Santa Fe Farmers Market. And so in the course of market organizing here in Texas, I heard so often from too many people that the kind of farmers I was looking for didn't exist, that it really was not possible to make a living in independent agriculture unless you were really a huge farmer, and that I might find hobby growers or gardeners, but I couldn't build a farmer's market off of commercial growers. And I knew that wasn't true, and I got tired of hearing it, and I wanted to make this kind of farming and the people who do it, not only do it now, but have done it for a number of years commercially successfully, I wanted to make them more visible to a broader public, so that people interested in going into this kind of farming would know that it's being done. It's not just theoretically possible, it's being done. And I wanted people who want to eat good food and keep local farms in our areas to know that we can help make this happen by supporting local growers. And so I collected names to go with those that I already had. I contacted people I knew who might know other people. I contacted the Texas Department of Agriculture and got the list of certified growers. I just cast as wide a net as possible to collect as many names and contact information as possible. And then I selected from that list, I ruled out any that I knew were not established in commercial success, because that was one of my main criteria, was demonstrated commercial success. And then I sent a very short questionnaire, either by email or regular mail, to commercially established farmers, or those that I thought were. And I got a very high return on those questionnaires. I asked questions, just basic questions like, what do you grow? How long have you grown it? Are you certified organic? Do you use organic methods, but you're not certified? What are your markets? How long have you been commercial growers? And then from those responses, I selected more than 20 growers from a range of geographical areas in Texas and a range of products, and made visits with the photographer who worked with me I made more than 30 visits. Some farms and ranches I visited more than once.
And many of the people I talked to in your book said that you spent a great deal of time with them, too. It wasn't just a quick visit, that you actually spent a lot of time with them.
Yeah, many hours. It ranged anywhere from 4 hours to, like, a total of 16 hours over a two-day, or even maybe more than 16 hours over a three-day period. And they were very, very generous with their time. And I walked around with a little cassette recorder and recorded their descriptions of how they got where they are, why they got into the work that they do, why they stay with it, how they market their products, and the challenges they have faced. And people were very generous. What I discovered, not surprisingly really, is we like to talk about ourselves. And so if there was ice that needed to be broken, once that ice was broken, conversation usually flowed easily. And I also discovered that those of us involved in local farm and food community development, whether we are interested in good food or we grow that good food, we're really passionate about this business. And so it was fascinating and wonderful to research the book. And then from those interviews, I had to cull, books can only be so long. And so I had to really work hard to choose those that I thought would give a really broad picture of in a product range and a regional range, mm-hmm. as I said. And it was very, very hard to leave.
It must have been really hard, but one of the things I think is outstanding about the book is that instead of just a short description of a lot of farmers and rancher operations in the state, you go into intimate detail and on with just 11 stories in 10 chapters. And by doing that, you get so much more out of reading their stories and their connection to what they're doing than if you had just done a bigger, broader overview. And it's really a delightful read.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. That's the kind of response I hoped for, because I'm fascinated by people's life stories, and I was aiming for that kind of interest.
And hopefully today on the show, we're going to talk to three of the people that are in your book, and we'll get a little glimpse into that intimate life story that they've recounted to you, and expand on some of that on our show. One of the things, Pam, I did want to get to asking you is, you say in the book that the expansion of organic agriculture is being driven not from the top down but from the ground up, and I just wondered if you could take a minute or two to expand on that.
Well, I think that from the beginning of what some people call the organic movement, and not so much the organic certification program, that it has been consumer-driven. For one thing, small farming and organic farming never really died out the way we might suppose, because big farming and conventional chemical farming has been the policy of the United States Department of Agriculture since World War II, really. Mm-hmm. So I think that it has always existed. And then, of course, in the 60s and 70s, consumer interest was revived. I mean, everyone who has read very much knows the impact of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and then for me, a huge influence in my reading life was reading Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America in the 70s. And so I think that gradually consumer concerns about the natural environment and the food we eat and nutrition has just gained momentum over the years. And now we see greater interest than ever. For example, recent USDA figures show that the number of small farms is increasing at a higher rate than big farms, and more farmers than ever are direct marketing, selling their products directly to the public, because there is a huge, huge demand for good, clean, fair food, to use a slow food description for what people want.
Well, is that where you see the future of sustainable agriculture heading, more towards direct marketing and more farmers markets and more community markets, and not so much the assimilation of the organic products into the larger food system, distribution system?
Well, I see both things happening. I think that industrial-scale organic is growing. We all know that it is in this country and in other countries, including China, which, as you know, the huge area that might be dedicated to industrial-scale organic agriculture. So I don't see the industrial food system, either the conventional chemical one or the industrial scale organic agriculture, going away. At the same time, I think that there are greater opportunities than ever for independent, smaller scale organic agriculture for the reasons that we have just been talking about. And I think it will expand. I think it is expanding. And so I see both things, or all three facets of agriculture, continuing.
Mm-hmm. So, and you definitely you're lamenting in the book to some degree that there aren't more farmers markets and more communities so that more of us can buy our local food from a direct farmer, directly from a farmer, and make it a regular part of our routines. Now, I know that you, as you mentioned earlier, you spent a great deal of effort organizing a farmers market, and I think you've been critically involved with at least two farmers markets, and not everybody has that the ability to do that. But on the other hand, how do we change this so that we can have more farmers markets, more community markets, and what are you seeing is the best ways to encourage this?
I'm so glad you asked that question. One of the things that we can do is, for one thing, make food issues political issues. As more than one person has said, the farm bill should be called the food bill. So we should make our concerns about eating good food and preserving and expanding farms in our area a political issue. Vote not just with our money at farmers markets and CSAs, but vote at the ballot box for elected officials, including in Texas, the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture is an elected official. So we should make it a political issue. We should also support organizations that support and help expand small, independent, organic agriculture. For example, the Texas Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and comparable organizations in other states has educational events to help grow more growers. We need to support those organizations with our money and with our time. We also need to support organizations such as the Austin-based but national in scope Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and then the Washington, D.C.-based Food and Water Watch, which lobby legislators for regulations and legislation that serves the interests of independent agriculture, not large-scale, corporate, mostly chemical agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
We need to work against the prevailing policies at the state levels and the national level that always seem to resort in a one-size-fits-all. For example, the proposed national animal identification system, which would penalize small ranchers by requiring every rancher, every livestock owner, to electronically trace every animal, is prohibitive for small growers.
And unnecessary.
And, yes, and unnecessary. So and there's so much work to be done to make more and more people aware that farming issues are food issues, and that it involves not just voting with our money, but voting with our time and involvement in politics and policy.
Right. And what about growing our own food? I mean, not just on a commercial level that farmers and ranchers are doing, but do you see a connection with again spreading the good word about real food that way?
I do. I think that for so many of us who are involved in local farm and food community development, we are either gardeners ourselves or we were closely connected to people who were farmers or were gardeners. And I think that that kind of connection inspires a lot of us to do the work that we do, and I think it's important to promote home gardening, but also, as you know, to promote good food in schools and school gardens on the model of, most famously, but not the only case, Alice Waters' Edible Schoolyard. So at every level, we need to educate people about the benefits of eating good food, including growing our own.
Right, right. Well, that's so true. And Pam, I know that you're on a tight schedule. You have a book tour going on right now, and I wanted to mention that the next stop will be in Austin this Friday at Book People. We're putting together, Edible Austin is putting together a local food tasting table with foods made from several of the people featured in the book, and we're lucky we're going to have quite a few of your subjects in the book at the event as well, and that will include Carol Ann Sale, who will be on the air with us in a few minutes, from Boggy Creek Farm, Betsy Ross, who she ranches grass-fed beef, and Eastside Cafe will be making their famous Betsy Ross chili for our food tasting table. Amelia Sweetheart from Pure Luck Farm and Dairy and Mike Sams from Full Quiver Farm and Dairy both are in the book, and they'll be at the event and sampling their wonderful artisan cheeses. And we're really excited because Dennis Holbrook is coming all the way from South Texas, and he has South Tex Organics, and he's bringing his first crop of Meyer lemons. And,
oh, my goodness.
One of our really treasured pastry chefs here in Austin, Jessica Mayer, is going to be making some delightful desserts for us with those, so I'm really excited about that. And then last but not least, David Petrie and Katie Kramer from Tecolote Farm will also be at the event, and we'll have David on the show in a little bit, too.
Oh, great. So I'm very excited about
very excited
event.
About this event,
so
and I just want
to
wish
Marla,
you,
Marla, and the book people for making this possible.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm really excited about the rest of your tour. Go to edibleaustin.com for more information. And Pam, do you have a website you'd like to
well,
tell people to go to?
I don't have a website per se, but if you go to growinggoodthingstoeat.com, it takes you to the Texas A&M University Press website page for my book, which provides a lot of interesting information.
Right, and you don't have to live in Texas to enjoy this book. I want to point out that these are the stories of organic farmers and ranchers everywhere, and so you can really relate to what you'll read in the book, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful read. So thank you, Pam. I really appreciate your being on the show.
Marla, thank you for all that you do.
And you know, it keeps some good vegetables.
Dorada! Ooh, Cantrice, come on, here
you go. I gotta get some okra tonight.
Oh, some corn and
some
snap peas.
You got some collard greens.
Blueberry, I'm gonna get some blueberries.
The green banana, I don't know about all that.
I'm gonna make some collards too.
Hi, this is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks so much for joining us. With us now is organic farmer, writer, and blogger Carol Ann Sale. I'm going to read just the very first part of the lead in Tam's book to set the stage. East Austin is home to some of the city's poorest people and richest soils, according to Carol Ann Sale, and she should know. Since 1992, she and her husband, Larry Butler, have lived at 3414 Lyons Road, raising vegetables year-round on 5 certified organic acres of land surrounding their house. Situated just 2.5 miles east of the Texas State Capitol, a brisk 30-minute walk, Carol Ann notes, Boggy Creek Farm and its neighborhood bear no resemblance to that dressed-up pink granite world. So, welcome to the show, Carol Ann.
Thank you, Marla. It's a pleasure.
It's always delightful to have you on the show, and in this case, you are a guest of honor because you are one of the chapters in Pam's book, Growing Good Things to Eat in Texas. So I just think it's wonderful that you're going to be able to talk to us about what Pam was so well able to do in the book, which is bring out a lot of very intimate details about how you and Larry got involved in farming.
That's right. In fact, we felt like we spilled the beans. So, but she did a great job. I mean, she does. There are a lot of details, and I think people want details. It's not just a glossed-over, simple discussion of all these farmers. It's talking about their lives. And so I think that's very. It was interesting to us to read about the other farmers, to tell you the truth.
Oh, definitely. It's as much a people book as it is a book about farming and farmers. So, but one of the things I wanted to ask you is that you and Larry plant in terms of not four seasons, but which is the typical farming seasons people think of, but two seasons, and you've called them hot and not hot. So I wondered if you could tell us specifically what you grow in these two seasons.
Well, you know, actually, you think of January as being the start of the year, but for us, the start of the year is right now, September. We're getting our land ready, and transplants are going in, and we're sowing seeds, and this is when it all begins. This is the clean break between the hot season and the cold season. And right now, I've got chard and beets up. The last green beans are in the ground and blooming, and Larry's got squash and cucumbers blooming. So we do a little bit of the last possible summer crops, but coming in will be the greens of the fall, like the kales and the spinaches and lettuces. And there will be a brief moment where, you know, we'll have some of the hot weather crops and some of the cooler weather crops together. For instance, at some years it's possible to have lettuce and tomatoes at the same time, but usually only for a week or two, and then the frost gets the tomatoes and they're out of here. So, but we start with our whole crop list is divided between hot and cold, and so in October and November and December and on into spring, there aren't any squashes except for hard squash, which will also die when the cold weather comes.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, it's we're doing the peas and turnips and beets and carrots and escaroles and endive and radicchio and head lettuces and salad mixes of all kinds. We do about 7 different salad mixes all winter long, from about mid-October to about May 1st, because then May 1st starts the hot season again. So it is very different. Up north, you have all of this stuff in the summer, generally, spring to early fall, all at one time. And I think a lot of our cookbooks reflect that. We'll see cookbooks, and we'll say, well, I can't make that recipe. That doesn't grow right now, whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. We have to change out all the ingredients in most of the cookbooks because they reflect a season up there, up north, where everything grows at the same time.
Right. And to that end, too, talk a little bit about your philosophy. You and Larry have a philosophy of growing as much variety of vegetables and fruits as possible at all the time. And you say in the book that you really see this as one of the keys to your success. You guys have been very successful at organic farming for a long time now, and you talked about having this great variety as being key to that.
Well, this is true. You know, if people have to drive over to our farm to buy our produce. And we don't go to farmers markets anymore. If you go to a farmers market, you can take maybe 3 different items because people come to the market, can round out the purchases and have a lot of diversity because there's so many farmers. But we're the farmer on our farm, and so we have to serve them the same variety that they might get at a farmers market. And so that's what our goal is. Our goal is to have 25 to 30 different vegetable, greens, whatever it is, types of things, so that they can pick out the three or four or five or six items they want and feel like they got all the vegetables they need. And so that's been very important to us. Also, through the years, Larry used to do a lot of canning. He doesn't anymore because the demand for the produce is so great. But we like to have other things at the farm stand to complement our vegetables. And for this reason, we buy in dairy from two different goat dairies so that we have cheese and milk and ice cream and yogurt. And then we buy in grass-fed meats from several growers. And so we have everything, really everything that the person needs, except maybe their booze and their dog food and the toilet paper. And generally, they can take everything from our farm stand and go home and make fabulous meals for the next few days. And that's what we want. We want to keep them out of the grocery store.
Well, and you, as I said, you and Larry have been very successful with that. And I think people enjoy going to your farm stand because it is like a one-stop shop. But everything, it's all fresh, all local, and all organic, and of course, very delicious. Tell me, we just have about a minute left, but okay. I want you to tell me what you're going to be making to bring to the Pam Walker's Book People event this Friday.
Okay. Well, right now, we're fortunate that we grow arugula year-round. This is one of those crops that we have year-round. And so I'll have a big arugula salad. And our pears have been coming in, our Texas hard, crisp pears, and so I'll grate those over the arugula. And then I will I'll crush up some cashews, some roasted cashews, sprinkle that over it, and then some feta cheese, and then just do an olive oil, lemon juice, Meyer lemon juice dressing and pour over it. And that will be it.
Oh,
and it'll be great.
That sounds fantastic. So, well, Caroline, I'm going to let you go until the next show, and
okay.
We'll look forward to having you back. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Marla. Bye-bye.
Strawberry, strawberry. First pea, first green. Peanuts, walnuts, hickory nuts. And I have some okra too.
Aye, aye,
uh-huh. Okra.
Aye, aye,
okra. Okra.
Aye, aye,
okra. Okra.
Aye, aye,
okra. 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 Okra.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Well, Bart Reed grows shrimp in the desert, in Imperial, Texas, to be exact. It's a Trans-Pecos town of 300 people at the junction of farm-to-market roads 11 and 1053, 55 miles southwest of Odessa and 30 miles north-northwest of Fort Stockton, Texas. So Bart is a farmer. He's a marine biologist, and he, along with his wife Patsy, is also a former restaurateur. And together they have Permian Sea Organics, which they started in 2003, where they farm mostly shrimp in an organic aquaculture system. So welcome, Bart.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're really excited that you're with us today. So, Bart, one of the things I think would be interesting for our listeners is for you to give us just a brief description of what the difference is between sustainable organic aquaculture and the commercial aquaculture.
Well, for the most part, there's quite a bit of difference. The conventional system is like a feedlot approach. You stock as many animals as you can get in your pond, lots of aeration, electrical paddle wheels to provide oxygen. You feed just huge amounts of a commercial feed, shrimp feed or fish feed, and for the most part, every input in the system comes from the outside. The animals are totally reliant on you. It's an intensive care unit for aquatic animals, and the organic system is much different in that we're building a system that an aquatic environment that sustains itself, that has its own flora and fauna, and the shrimp will then feed on that natural productivity in the pond. We do give them an artificial prepared feed, which is made from organic. All the ingredients are organic, and off the list of approved vitamins and minerals and that sort of thing. But it's the stocking densities are much lower. Generally, we don't use electrical aeration, it's not an intensive care unit. It's more like a micro environment like they would have in nature.
Right, and it's a completely cyclical system too, where everything is part of it, works together and stays.
Yeah. We fertilize with compost to start the pond, the algae and that sort of thing in the pond, and we recycle all our water. None of our water leaves our facility, goes anywhere, discharges or anything. It all stays here. Everything. You know, it's a system that takes care of itself with a little help from me and my family.
Yeah, your management skills.
Yeah.
So, Bart, one of the things that you did a while back was you founded the Organic Aquaculture Institute, or OAI, and it's a nonprofit research organization that brings together researchers, entrepreneurs, and aquaculturists to do research and then to develop and promote organic products and to, I would assume, to raise awareness of this with the consumers as well.
Right.
In marketing. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to start this and where you're going with it and what are you working on right now?
Yeah, OAI is dedicated to trying to, further organic aquaculture and really put it in the hands of fish farmers and show them how it works and how you can do it and prove to them that it works. It's not, we try to do a lot of, all hands-on, real-world, four-acre pond type research projects so that, it's not some experiment somebody did in a lab in an aquarium somewhere and extrapolated out to a big pond. It's real organic aquaculture type work. OAI is a not-for-profit research company, and of course we were funded through some grants, donations, that sort of thing, and just any way we can get funding really. And we did the very first work on elimination of fish meal for shrimp diets. And we grew crops and have since grown crops of shrimp without any fish meal in their diet, which was was considered to be an impossibility.
Who said that was an impossibility? Was that in school?
Well, fish nutritionists and scientists in general that have studied fish and aquaculture have always felt that fish meal was necessary in the diet, and our philosophy was, fish don't make fish. Essential oils, omega-3 fatty acids, are what the fish, marine fish and shrimp have to have that. But they don't get it. Fish don't actually produce fish oil. Algae produces fish oil. So our philosophy was, why don't we culture the algae that produce the fish oil in this pond system, and the shrimp then, by their omnivorous feeders, they graze on what's in the pond as well as the feed you feed them and whatnot, and they would get their fish, their essential fatty acids, the fish oil, if you will, from that ecosystem, and it worked, and it's the, we believe, a system that would work for crustaceans, for sure. We've seen that, and possibly for fish as well. So one of our big goals was to work on the elimination of fish meal in aquaculture diets. General organic aquaculture practices, just the day-to-day stuff that you don't think about. I mean, farmers spray weeds along their levee with Roundup and things like that. You can't do that in a organic system. You know, you've got to learn to take care of your whole farm in an organic way. And so there are little things that people don't think about when you're managing a farm that you have to consider when you're doing this organically. And then the other thing we're interested in is alternative species. You know, this is fairly new field, organic fish farming, and we don't know what all species are going to be suitable and adapt well to this sort of management. And so one of the things we're trying to do is test some alternative species, speckled trout from the coast, redfish. Would like to try some flounder, some different species, and see what all we can, if we can grow the organic aquaculture industry by doing some of this groundwork that's really not being done anywhere.
So you're doing this through the Organic Aquaculture Institute and the monies that you receive from that, and I take it that conventional research in the universities in general aren't really focused on this sort of thing, and so from that reason, it's really important to support your work in this.
Yeah, it that's exactly the case. The universities and typical research organizations aren't really set up to do organic aquaculture type work, and nor do they seem terribly interested in it either. So it's really not being done, and we felt like it was necessary. Now, we have a board of directors that come from various backgrounds, some commercial fish aquaculturists and some university professors and all that are interested in this work, but don't actually get to do it at their universities because they're not set up and they're not, it's not something that's got a very, I mean, I think only in the last couple of years has there been even any targeted research money just for organics in general, and that spread out across terrestrial farming, all sorts of agriculture, and with the aquaculture thrown in there to compete for that same money. So,
right, and yeah. I think aquaculture isn't even thought of as the front. Well, it is the frontier probably, but it isn't thought of as the main recipient of what few funds there are to study organics, because most people think of organics and they think of vegetables and growing crops, and then maybe they start thinking about the proteins, but more of the grass-fed type proteins and not so much the water culture proteins.
Right, and part of that is because aquaculture in general is behind the curve a bit in agriculture, because it's a fairly new field compared to some of the other agriculture. And then the organic certification and designation for aquaculture is also very new and in the process of being worked out. So it is a bit behind a bit from
well,
other agriculture.
Bart, if you could talk a little bit about that. I know that when you first started Permian Sea Organics, you guys were very rigorous about getting an organic certification. At that time, it was possible through the regular land organic certification program. And at some point, and you found a market for it. You had the potential to raise quite a bit of product. And then at some point, it was decided that the land organic standards didn't apply or shouldn't apply the same way to aquatic cultivation, and so they actually ended that program, and that decertified you in a strictly standards way, and so you lost a huge opportunity to market what you had been working so hard at. This is one of the most poignant things I think in Pam's book, is how a governmental setback like this can really wreak havoc on a business, especially one in pursuit of something as alternative is organic farming right now. So what I understand you're on the board now to try to come up with aquatic standards for organics?
Yeah, it's the aquatic working group, which is a working group for the National Organic Standards Board, made up of specialists in aquaculture and there's really a broad array of people. There's some people from NGOs. There's some scientists from universities. There's several fish farmers. It's a big group that got together over. Well, we've been doing this for years now. I don't even know how many, but basically since about 2003, when all of that changed, and we've given our recommendations, sat down, hashed out what is organic and where should we be, and we make our recommendations to the National Organic Standards Board. They review them, tweak them to suit their liking, and then. It goes out for public comment, goes back for review again, on and on until it is adopted by the National Organic Standard Board, which then sends it to the National Organic Program, and then they spend their time turning our recommendations into workable regulations for certification in aquaculture. And so, yeah, we started out, we took what was already there for the idea. This was Permian Sea Organics back when we first got certified, took what was already in place for, like, cattle and livestock, the livestock rules. And we figured that fish and shrimp were essentially livestock. So we set our rules based on those regulations, got the certification, then I guess there was enough concern that perhaps aquatic biology and aquatic agriculture was significantly different enough from terrestrial that it wouldn't be that easy. It seemed so at the time, but they decided it wouldn't be, and that we should have an incomplete set of rules for aquaculture. And so that's what this group has been working on for years. It's a very
Bart, is this something that people can weigh in on? And you mentioned there will be hopefully a period of public comment that we could help move this along. I know that the sooner this happens, the better for you commercially, and I'm sure for many other people who could be getting involved in organic aquaculture if there were these opportunities.
Yeah,
I definitely think the market demand is there for it. So I want to do two things. One, if you can let people know how they can maybe support this, and then secondly, if you could tell us how can we get your product, because I know you are following strict organic practices, even if it's not labeled as such, and when is your harvest coming, and how do we get it?
Okay, well, first of all, as far as the organic rules and what's going on in the organic, the official organic. One thing you can do is read Pam's book. That's a good way of learning about what's going on. But the USDA, the National Organic Program, and I don't know what the website is right at the top of my head at the moment. But USDA, you can get to the National Organic Program's website, and they have a page for the public comments. They post what's going on. And that's kind of the place to weigh in, is through their website, the NOP website. And you can follow what's going on there. Whether or not the public can force that to go any faster, I don't know. But
right. Well,
that's
it
how
can't
you can
hurt.
Do that.
So we can encourage people to do that. And so tell us quickly, where can we get in touch with
you
to get product?
The best way is to come to my farm and purchase it when we harvest, which will be not until the weather it turns cold. We keep them growing as long as possible. But anybody is certainly welcome to come here and purchase product. We have a store in town. We sell it on the levee. I'll bring it to you if it's reasonable. We do whatever we can. What you can do is contact me. I'll give my phone number and my email address. I don't have a really good website at the moment, so we won't worry about that. But my email address is spelled like my name. It's R-E-I-D, and then an underscore, and then Bart, B-A-R-T. So it's read underscore Bart at yahoo.com. And my phone number is 432-536-2216. And you can call and figure, I can give you directions, tell you when we're harvesting. You can pester your local stores and whatnot to contact us to carry the product. We have some local stores and restaurants that do that. And the people can help get their product there by insisting that their local stores carry this stuff and work with us and get it
that
out.
That sounds great, Bart. Okay, I'm going to thank you very much for joining us. We're going to move along to our next guest, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
First green, peanuts, walnuts, hickory nuts. And I have some okra, too. From his Mary's backyard, plenty, plenty tomatoes.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. David Petrie and Katie Kramer grow 150 varieties of vegetables each year on just 5 to 6 acres of their certified organic 55-acre farm, which is called Tecolote. The farm lies 15 miles east of downtown Austin on the western edge of what once was Blackland Tallgrass Prairie. So welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So we really have enjoyed having guests from the book, Pam's book, Growing Good Things to Eat in Texas, on the show today. And I wanted to not only thank you for coming on the show, but we won't make you tell any intimate details of your inner life, but I do have some questions for you. I'll encourage people to read the book for that. But you have a quote in the book that I really caught my imagination, and that was, you said that my whole goal with every type of vegetable is to find the tastiest varieties that can be grown here and grow them. How do you grow about doing this?
Oh, boy. I wish I could just put it in a nutshell. It takes experience, one. Learning, not just the sort of traditional farming practices as well as modern farming practices, but I think it also takes a love of food. I think you really have to care about what you're doing in order to produce a product or a food that's really worthwhile. You have to have a passion for it, and I do. I grew up in a family that's really passionate about food, and that's what brought me into farming. And that's like I said, I just think you really have to love what you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you say you have to really love cooking and eating, I think that is one of the things that makes your farm outstanding is that you don't grow just like three varieties of squash. You have many more than that, and many varieties nobody's ever tasted before, and they really don't have any way to have access to these kinds of vegetables any other way than to get them from your farm.
Yeah. Well, I think tell me again what you were just saying. I'm sorry.
Pardon, can you hear me?
Yeah, it's sort of a bad connection, but I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, I know you're fading in and out too. I don't know if we can maybe get our engineer to help us with that a little bit, but
you're talking about the varieties that we grow.
Yeah, that you can't really get what you grow anywhere else but from your farm, and that means wherever farmers market you go to. Or I think the other thing I wanted to get you to talk about is the whole concept of alternative to farmers markets is to have and develop a CSA. And I think Tecolote was one of the first CSAs, or community supported agriculture programs, in Texas. Is that right?
One of them. We don't want to lay claim to the first, but yeah, one of them.
One of the oldest.
That's really what has sort of, you know, kept me from, I guess, getting bored or overcome, you know, with the hardships in farming, is the fact that we do sell directly to the people who eat. I've never really had an interest in wholesaling produce. You know, I've worked with it before I started Tecolote Farm, and to me it was almost like manufacturing widgets in a way, in that it allows you to cut corners. It encourages you to cut corners. You know, if you're selling, whether it's the local Randall's or Whole Foods, you're competing internationally. And in order to keep your produce on the shelf there and be back from year to year, you have to sort of walk that fine line of cutting corners. You don't do that when you're selling to somebody directly, because you get that feedback from week to week. So you know, I love that personal connection. And it's really meaningful to me, because when I'm out there, I'm pulling a carrot, or I'm planting, you know, a tomato plant, or I'm reading seed catalogs, deciding what I'm going to grow. You know, I'm thinking about those people. I'm seeing faces. I'm thinking about names, and I'm thinking about the responses I got last year. And you know, the finding new varieties is really a hobby for me in a way. I guess I love different varieties of vegetables, and I guess also I go into the grocery stores and I see some contemporary, quote, organic food, or even what's called heirloom food, and really it's not much different than the conventional varieties, or I don't see really huge difference in quality. So I have a passion about, you know, trying to find some of those old traditional varieties. I'm not stuck on that. We grow a few hybrids. I'm very open to it, but I love trying to find that eggplant, really, that just has the perfect essence of eggplant grown here. You know, something that might be grown in New Jersey or Italy might not have that same expression that it has here. So really, it's a matter of trying to find these vegetables, and we try new varieties and do literally probably 100 different trials every year, and trying to find what does the best here.
So you're a true horticulturist. That takes a lot of research and a lot of a lot of caring about what you're growing, but also a lot of time in study and trial and error, it sounds like.
A lot of trial and error, yeah. We have, for every vegetable, you know, that you see at the farmer's market we have delivered, there were 10 or 15 representatives that were similar that never made it. So, yeah, the success rate of what stays on our farm from year to year is really low.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish we had a bit more time, David, but I wanted to end with this quote that's in your chapter of your story, and that's that it's a quote from Wendell Berry, and he says, "The life of farming can be, for the same person at the same time, close to unbearable and yet irresistible." And I think reading your chapter, I really came as close as anything in the book as understanding what the irresistible part of farming is by hearing your words on it.
Yeah, well, thank you. It is. It takes a love, because it's a difficult lifestyle.
Thank you so much, David, for being on the show with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks again to our guests today, and Pamela Walker in particular, for talking about her new book, Growing Good Things to Eat in Texas. Thank you all for listening to our Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for making this show possible. I'll be back on September 28th, and I'll announce the winner of Pamela Walker's book. So remember to email me at marla@edibleaustin.com. But tune in next Monday and every Monday for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network. And have a happy and sustainable Labor Day.